This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bahnsen Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the debate that never was. Sorry about that. I've come to Memphis, where sightings of Elvis are more common than sightings of my debate opponent, apparently. And I feel like, as a debater, like that statement puts it, all dressed up and nowhere to go. So what do you do when you have a debate and there's only one side talking? I'm going to try to do my best for you tonight to expand on the remarks that I would have been using in my presentation in the debate, and then in the place of answering my opponent, Dr. Michael Martin, I'll take his book, Atheism, A Philosophical Justification, and try to cross-examine it and offer something of what I'm sure you would have heard if he had been here anyway. It just won't be quite as entertaining, I guess, without having both of us here. The questions that you have as I am lecturing, I would really welcome to be written on the cards that have been distributed, so that after we have a brief break, I'll have an opportunity to interact with what you'd like to talk about and hopefully scratch where you itch intellectually. I've come to you this evening because I think when a person takes a public and a published position on an issue as momentous in its consequences as the existence or the non-existence of God, it is expected that he will stand up and give an account of his reasoning. The truth regarding an omnipotent personal creator is an objective public matter, and those who disagree over it, theists and atheists, should be willing and able to answer for the view to which they are committed. They should expect vigorous cross-examination to see if their views will withstand scrutiny. They should want anybody who wishes to do so to be able to check the public record of their debate to assess for themselves which side has the more cogent defense. And thus, as a Christian theist, I appreciate the opportunity to make a public case in favor of the truth of my faith. I regret that my opponent did not share these commitments or confidence in the public defensibility of his atheistic position, but more on that later. You know what I think would really be an interesting debate topic? I'd love to see two scholars come out here and debate the existence of air. That's what I'd like to see. That would be downright fascinating. Just think of it. Profound and articulate argumentation, cross-examination over whether air is real. All the while, the two disputants breathing air in and out as they puff and puff their arguments at each other. That'd be rather silly, wouldn't it? We're debating the existence of air while we are, in fact, breathing air as a precondition of our ability to debate. And I think it would be silly as a scholarly exercise for a person who offers erudite arguments against the existence of air to pursue that project as though air didn't exist, when in fact, contrary to his conclusions, he's using air all along. He would, in that case, be a living contradiction, since his argumentation would be possible. His argument would be possible only if his argument were wrong. I want you to think about that for a minute. He could argue against the existence of air, all the while breathing air, only if his argument proved to be wrong. And I believe that that is something of an illustration, a good illustration, of what is so wrong with a scholar trying to debate and show that God does not exist. He may argue this way, he may argue that way, he may enlist profound lines, erudite reasoning, but because the validity of what is assumed and the validity of what is utilized in debate, that is the cogency of logic, the cogency of language, objective knowledge, and a number of other things we'll mention this evening, since the validity of those things which are assumed in debate only makes sense within the theistic worldview, The atheist debater is like the man who, while continuing to breathe, argues that air does not exist. The existence of God is rationally necessary to rationality, to science, and to ethics, in which case the atheist must secretly take for granted the very thing he hopes to refute in order to engage in the debate at all. By participating in the debate, he has, in principle, already lost the debate. And this is what I would have liked to have said to Dr. Martin if he had been here this evening, that by coming to the debate, you've lost. Because debate itself presupposes things which are only intelligible within a theistic worldview, particularly, in my case, I would maintain the Christian theistic worldview. In Acts 17th chapter, the Apostle Paul said to the philosophers of Athens that in God we live and move and have our being. God is, to speak metaphorically, the intellectual atmosphere that we breathe whenever we attempt to be rational or logical, whenever we attempt to use language or to learn things scientifically. Any attempt then to rationally disprove God would in itself undermine the very rationality which the debater utilized. Philosophically, depending upon the theistic worldview, again, without admitting it any more than the person who argues against air admits that he's breathing, philosophically, depending upon the theistic worldview, he pursues the futile errand of demonstrating that atheism is true instead. And I'd like to explain that to you this evening. Years ago, Aristotle wrote that man by nature desires to know, that that's part of our human nature. We all want to be able to know. Philosophy pursues the systematic and the self-critical maturation and fulfillment of that desire to know. And it's my conviction that atheism as a philosophy makes it impossible to achieve this goal of knowing what we all do in fact know. Human beings seek to understand themselves and seek to understand the world in which they live. They seek to explain things, to make their experience intelligible in terms of some larger context than isolated and momentary sensations. With knowledge, they gain a measure of control over their environment, and that enables them to make life more comfortable and safe, more successful and personally satisfying. As a person becomes more intellectually mature, he brings discipline now to the study of whatever aspect of experience fascinates or interests him. He seeks greater precision in description, greater clarity in conceptualization, coherence between the various kinds of explanation he offers for the different aspects of his experience. As we might say, he attempts to become more scientific through the development of systematic and general laws in terms of which experience is conceptually and causally explainable and, to some degree, predictable. But this scientific level of thinking, disciplined, systematic approach to various aspects of experience, this scientific level of thinking is never an end for human inquiry. And that's because questions will inevitably arise about the nature and the extent and the assumptions of science, and particularly questions about the relationship between the different sciences, say, between physics and psychology and history and grammar and on and on. And this brings us unavoidably then to philosophical reflection. Philosophy is concerned with the presuppositions and the conceptual muddles which arise in any and all fields of study, rather than being about some separate area of human experience. Philosophy also seeks a world and life view in terms of which all of the elements of human experience and the various ways in which they are explained or made intelligible can be unified into a coherent outlook. To put it simply, philosophy has a critical function on the one hand as well as a constructive function on the other. And I'd like to quote one of my favorite philosophers, Bertrand Russell, in this regard. In 1924, in Contemporary British Philosophy, in an article entitled Logical Atomism, Russell wrote, "The business of philosophy, as I conceive it, is essentially that of logical analysis, followed by logical synthesis. Comprehensive construction is part of the business of philosophy. But I believe that the most important part, to my mind, consists in criticizing and clarifying notions which are apt to be regarded as fundamental and accepted uncritically." And so here we have somebody, a notorious atheist, who would endorse basically the platform on which I'm standing as I begin my lecture and presentation tonight. Philosophy is inevitable, and philosophy has two sides to it: critical cross-examination and the attempt to constructively bring together a unified picture of reality. The philosopher needs to question and cross-examine claims to the truth and efforts at explanation. Socrates put it best years ago when he said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." Philosophy seeks clarity and conceptual cogency, and it seeks well-grounded claims. On the other hand, philosophy is not satisfied to have bits and pieces of knowledge in various fields of study, or even widespread regions of human experience, left to be loose and disjointed without any intelligible relationship to each other. The philosopher seeks an overall picture of reality which gives a proper place to every detail of man's experience and knowledge. His quest is to develop an adequate worldview and corresponding philosophy of life. Philosophy forces us to face fundamental, conceptual, and systematically basic questions about the nature of reality, how we know what we know, and how men ought to behave. Just to give a very brief sampling to survey some of the major questions a philosopher has to ask. Philosophy asks, first of all, what are the ultimate principles by which we answer philosophical questions about reality, about knowledge, and about ethics? What are those ultimate principles? What are the principles that render experience intelligible and explain, predict, or control things? Are those principles organized? Are they logically consistent? Are they explicatable in language? Are they justifiable, or are they arbitrary? Secondly, when a philosopher tries to bring together a worldview, he's going to have to ask, how should we understand nature? Questions about matter and motion. Is there an underlying unity or identity through change in the way things appear in this world? Is there an objective order in the world? And if it is objectively ordered, is it a mechanical order or a purposeful, teleological order? Thirdly, philosophers ask questions like, what is man's place and function in the universe? What is his special dignity, if any? And what is the meaning of life? How do values fit into the realm of nature? Are values objective, and by what standard should men live? And fourthly, philosophers ask, is man's mind self-sufficient? Is reason an instrument for obtaining objective knowledge of reality? Should man follow his sense perceptions, his observations, or should men follow their rational conceptions and various kinds of coherence that they bring to experience? How do sense perceptions and rational conceptions relate to each other? Now, everyone utilizes some network of presuppositions regarding these matters. I realize that will surprise many of you because you're sitting there thinking, I've never in my life thought such a thing. That question has never been put to me in that way. I've never come up with it that way. But that's not my point. I'm just trying to be precise and to the point when I utter the questions with that kind of technical language. My point is that all of us have views on these matters. In fact, it's inevitable that we're going to have views. We live in terms of those views. Everyone utilizes a network of presuppositions regarding questions like these, although for most people, it is a network of presuppositions that is implicit rather than explicit, unclear rather than precise, and poorly developed rather than well thought out. Philosophy forces a critical investigation of differing worldviews. And yet, for all of that, it more often than not fails to reach unanimity of opinion. Why? Why is it that philosophers who are supposed to be so intelligent, so precise, so critically minded, why don't they come to agreement on these basic issues? The reason why philosophical disputes tend to be so difficult to resolve is that there are profound differences between the worldviews of those who are party to the disputes in philosophy, and particularly to those who are party to a dispute over whether God exists or doesn't. Those worldviews will control the way in which factual evidence is accepted and interpreted, and thus they are not resolvable, these disputes between worldviews. They are not resolvable by simply looking and seeing what we observe about the world and deciding who's right and who's wrong. You may be able to decide who's right about the price of eggs at the market by driving down there and looking and seeing, but you cannot solve fundamental philosophical questions in that way. Conflicting presuppositions about reality, about knowledge, and about ethics determine what a person takes to be problematic, what's in need of explanation. They determine what can be taken for granted about experience and reality. That is, what is initially certain as we begin to reason. They determine what the nature of an adequate analysis or explanation or argument would be. That is to say, conflicting worldviews will focus on different problems, they'll have different starting points, and they'll pursue different methods and standards. It's little surprise, therefore, that adherents of different worldviews argue past each other and come to radically conflicting conclusions. And in light of these introductory remarks, any fruitful debate over the philosophical question of the existence of God will come down in the final analysis to an assessment of conflicting worldviews, the worldviews of the atheist and the theist. This is not a matter of saying, okay, now, we've gone to the market, we've found the egg counter, and we're going to look at what the posted price is. So you see, get two people in a room, and we've now come into this room, and we're going to look at the egg counter and say, now, is God there or not? It just doesn't work that way. We have to understand that the debate between the theist and the atheist is a debate over broader philosophical issues. In fact, a debate over entire worldviews. In the end, the issue is whether the underlying philosophy regarding reality, knowledge, and ethics to which either party is committed is cogent, is consistent, and warranted. In particular, we must ask whether atheism or theism as worldviews can provide the preconditions for making human experience intelligible, or whether they leave logic and science and ethics arbitrary and or incoherent. Let me put that to you again for those taking notes. We have to finally ask whether atheism or theism provide the preconditions for making human experience intelligible, or whether they leave science, logic, and ethics to be arbitrary and or incoherent. And it's just because the atheist worldview of Michael Martin undermines rationality and morality that it is philosophically unacceptable. What we all take for granted in terms of objective knowledge, linguistic meaningfulness, logical standards, scientific procedures, human freedom and dignity, and moral absolutes, because what we take for granted in terms of these things would become utterly unintelligible within the context of the atheist worldview because they do not comport with atheist assumptions. When the atheist tells us there is no God, that what we have is matter in motion, all of a sudden it becomes impossible to give a rational account of objectivity, human freedom, moral absolutes, linguistic meaning, logical standards, and scientific procedures. And that is the crucial defect, you see. Atheism is its own worst enemy in terms of debating. On the other hand, the worldview of Christian theism, I believe, is the philosophical perspective in which all of these things are simultaneously intelligible. It's the philosophical context within which they individually and together make sense. And therefore, the atheist who attempts to use language and logic to support, in any scientific fashion, the refutation of theism is assuming the very thing he's aiming to refute, though he hides that from himself. He's like the man who argues there is no air, all the while breathing. To use the words of Cornelius Van Til, to put it real simply, anti-theism presupposes theism. Anti-theism, in order to be intelligible, presupposes theism. I can state my case briefly, and I'll come right to the point. The proof of Christian theism, which I offer you tonight, is this: that in terms of philosophical worldviews, without Christian theism, you cannot prove anything. The proof of Christian theism is that without that worldview, you cannot prove anything. And that's because the atheistic worldview, say of a Michael Martin, does not comport with the concepts and the principles of logic, science, language, human freedom, and moral obligation, in which case it cannot prove or so much as give an account of knowing anything whatsoever. Atheism intellectually fails as a worldview and thus profoundly refutes itself. The point here is not merely that the atheist cannot show that he knows God doesn't exist. My point is really much more fundamental. It's that he cannot show that he knows anything whatsoever in terms of a broader philosophical theory which could justify those claims. Consequently, you will find the persistent response of atheists to their inability to advance a systematic philosophy in the style of a Plato or an Aristotle or whoever. You'll find that consistently the response of atheists to their failure to develop a systematic philosophy, their failure to devise a credible, coherent worldview regarding reality, knowledge, and ethics, is simply to dismiss the question of worldviews and pretend it's unimportant or somehow inaccessible. That is to say, what I'm not able to do well is not important. And so if there's some kind of philosophical demand on me to develop a worldview in which I can make sense of my argumentation, then so much the worse for the demand for a worldview. Because the one thing the atheist knows for certain to begin with, not at the end of the investigation, but at the beginning, is that God is not going to be allowed to exist. And so if I need the existence of God to make sense of my argument, if I need that for a credible worldview, then it'd be better just to say we don't need worldviews. And of course, all of philosophy in the late 20th century is pretty much infected with this kind of disease. The big questions will no longer be considered. It's either somehow incoherent or without meaning to talk about them, or answers are not accessible, and so whatever's not accessible can't be important. It's kind of like the man who says, whatever my net doesn't catch can't be fish. Anything that I can't get hold of and control can't be important. And so atheists will just kind of, you know, run off and say, that's not important, we don't need a worldview. But it's just because the atheist worldview is self-refuting and undermines the intelligibility of rationality, objectivity, moral absolutes, science, human dignity, and freedom, that the atheist worldview makes it impossible to argue for the atheist worldview. The point is not merely, then, that the atheist cannot show that he knows God doesn't exist. My point is more broadly, the atheist can't show that he knows anything. And yet atheists are very intelligent people. I want to make very clear that I'm not here standing to tell you atheists are not brilliant men. I think Michael Martin is a very intelligent man, a very hard-working scholar. See, I pay attention to his books. I wouldn't do that if I didn't believe that and have that kind of respect for him. On the other hand, I don't believe that atheists understand themselves as well as they think. And that though they reject the existence of God outwardly by profession, the only way in which they can make sense of their rational procedures at all is to secretly depend upon that worldview anyway. Let me again quote Dr. Van Til. Christianity can be shown to be not just as good as, or even better than, the non-Christian position, but the only position that does not make nonsense of human experience. Only in the context of the Christian worldview can we give an account of math, give an account of history, an account of literature, an account of science, an account of industry, civil government, and every other aspect or facet of human experience. And this is why we say that God has made his existence and his character abundantly clear to all men. The evidence for God's existence is pervasive and inescapable, since God is the precondition for the intelligibility of man's experience and man's reasoning. Those who deny God render their thinking futile and foolish in terms of the need for a critically minded philosophical worldview. The same challenge to unbelief was issued in the ancient world by the Apostle Paul, who wrote, "Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age?" That has more poignancy tonight. Where is the debater of this age? "Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world?" Paul wrote to the Colossians in chapter 2 of that epistle, "In Christ are deposited all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, in which case those whose philosophy is not according to Christ, but rather according to the elements of human speculation, will be robbed of knowledge. They'll be robbed of the ability to justify their truth claims." These are the things that the apostle wrote years ago. And that theme in the Apostle Paul echoes the Old Testament book of Proverbs, which teaches us at the very outset that the beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. The fear of the Lord is the head. It's the beginning, the most important point in knowing anything. David thus wrote in the Psalms, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." Atheism is intellectually indefensible because as a worldview, it would make it impossible, if one is consistent, to justify any claims to knowledge, whether they're religious claims or mundane claims, whether they're about transcendent matters or the details of ordinary life. And I'd like to illustrate this point from the history of philosophy tonight, taking four major illustrations. I want to consider briefly a few noteworthy philosophers who, in at least rough approximation, shared Dr. Martin's affiliation with something like logical positivism. If you look at chapter 2 of his book, Atheism and Philosophical Justification, you see that he's willing to hold on to this school of thought. He thinks that it hasn't been as discredited as many philosophers would tell you today. And so I'm going to look at four philosophers who were not, strictly speaking, logical positivists, but had many similar themes and commitments in their approach to philosophy. What is distinctive for our purposes here is their commitment to a rigorously empirical theory of knowledge, a theory of knowledge that is tied to observation or perception, and a corresponding rejection of God's existence, or at least the rejection of any cognitive factual knowledge of God's existence. The attempt to develop this kind of outlook, rigorously empirical, anti-transcendent, the attempt to develop that kind of outlook has always proved unsuccessful in the history of philosophy, and even worse, it has proved self-refuting. We can quickly survey the philosophical inadequacy of such an approach if we look at Epicurus in the ancient world, David Hume, Bertrand Russell, and Ludwig Wittgenstein. Let me begin with Epicurus. He was born about 341 BC and was a materialistic atomist in his theory of reality and a qualitative hedonist in his ethical philosophy of living. Epicurus held that philosophical methods should begin with the plain facts of sense perception and shape all opinions in terms of sense perception, augmented by the demand for non-contradiction. So, sensation and logic. According to him, following Democritus earlier, there is no such thing as spiritual reality, for reality is composed of an infinite number of qualitatively identical and self-propelling atoms whose arrangement and whose ceaseless motion explain the qualities of things and the behavior that we observe in the objects of this world. Everything that exists, according to Epicurus, even the gods, even the human soul, was explained materially and naturalistically. There was thus, he said, nothing to fear in death, and man should now live for the happiness or pleasure of tranquility. That was a quite popular philosophy in its day. It's popular in our day, but it's hardly a cogent philosophy upon cross-examination. Let's begin with this. The premise that all knowledge is perceptual in nature was not one which Epicurus knew on the basis of perception itself, and thus his philosophy refuted itself. Everything we know is based on perception. The question is, do you know that based on perception? And of course, there is no perception from which one could bring about that conclusion. Moreover, what Epicurus said about reality could not possibly have been known by means of perception. That is, he believed in the existence of imperceptibly small bits of matter. Well, he didn't know that by perception. He believed the number of those bits of matter to be infinite. No one has infinite perceptual knowledge, and that they were all in ceaseless motion. How could he know, unless he was watching them all the time, that those infinite bits of matter were in ceaseless motion? You see, on the one hand, he wanted to be strictly empirical, but that strict empiricism undermined what he wanted to say about reality. His naturalistic, atomistic theory of reality could not credibly explain man as having free will, since man is nothing but the mechanical combination of atoms falling through empty space. Epicurus himself offered the ad hoc and arbitrary theory that there must have been a swerve in the fall of these atoms, which accounts for man's unpredictability, what we call man's will. So the atoms are falling through space, man is just a mechanical combination of these atoms falling through space, and for some reason, this is what makes it arbitrary and ad hoc, the atoms, one atom swerved, and then there's all this billiard ball effect, and that's what brings unpredictability, and unpredictability is what we call human will. But of course, even that deprives man of purposeful choice and leaves us with the conclusion that since what our brains devise is mechanically determined or at times unexplicable due to swerves in the atoms, we have no basis for trusting our reasoning or that our reasoning has anything to do with an objective realm of truth. If we cannot help thinking what we do, why bother with philosophical investigation? Why bother debating at all? Given problems with his theory of knowledge, how could Epicurus know that there was no afterlife? See, that was a major premise of his ethical philosophy. But given his epistemological difficulties, the theory of knowledge, he couldn't say, he couldn't give any basis for his ethic. And what sense could he make of man having any ethical obligation whatsoever, much less the ethical obligation to seek the pleasure of tranquility? You see, Epicurus shows us that that approach to philosophy becomes nothing more than a subjective choice. Of course, as we've seen, his philosophy can't account for man making any choices either. So, I mean, it's got problems upon problems. The empiricism and atheism of Epicurus were completely inadequate to give an account of or to make possible rationality, objectivity, man's freedom, and moral absolutes. Let's turn to a second example. The Scottish skeptic David Hume, born in 1711, faced a similar plight due to his exclusively empirical method and his anti-metaphysical prejudices. Hume advanced a strictly empirical criterion of meaning. Let me quote him from an inquiry concerning human understanding. Hume said, "When we entertain, therefore, any suspicion that a philosophical term is employed without any meaning or idea, as is but too frequent, we need but inquire from what impression is that supposed idea derived." That kind of rigor, felt Hume, would lead us to take in hand, and I quote, any volume of divinity or school metaphysics and ask, does it contain any abstract reasoning concerning quantity or number? No. Does it contain any experimental reasoning concerning matter of fact and existence? No. Commit it then to the flames, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. Now, Dr. Martin would be pleased. But a more cautious philosopher will note the outcome of a consistent application of Hume's empirical method, from which Hume, unlike many modern disciples of Hume, did not flinch, namely, that our common philosophical notions, for all their traditional use and importance, proved to be not merely false, but nonsensical as well. Let me illustrate. For instance, we have no empirical impression of any underlying identity through change, either in the supposed objects of the external world or in ourselves as the subject of these impressions. There's nothing but temporal succession of one sensation after another. And there is no meaningful basis, then, for speaking of continuous objects of experience, nor any meaningful basis for speaking of a continuous I who experiences those illusory objects. I am nothing more, said Hume, than a loose bundle of perceptions. And even here, he had no warrant for speaking of these loose perceptions being bundled, since there was no empirical impression of such a bundling. According to Hume, there could be no evidence which would justify our practical belief in an external world whatsoever. And I quote, "The mind has never anything present to it but the perceptions and cannot possibly reach any experience of their connection with objects. The supposition of such a connection is therefore without any foundation in reasoning." Put it very simply, Hume said, we're all caught in an egocentric predicament because we never see any connection between our impressions and our mind and objects outside the world, and therefore we can't even say that there's a rational foundation for believing in an external world. Furthermore, argued Hume, the idea that there's a causal connection between any two events, despite the fact that it embodies the underlying belief of all empirical science, the uniformity of nature, to put it in a cavalier way, is likewise without any rational foundation. While you may experience a succession of events, you never perceive a necessary or causal connection between the events that you experience. Hume put it this way, we can never observe any tie between them. In that case, science can only report past observations to us, and every event is, as it were, a brand new event about which nothing can be rationally said by way of inductive inference or future prediction, not even probably said. And so, as you can see, Hume's strict empiricism landed him in utter skepticism. By his own admission, Hume wouldn't have to come to a debate to be shown that. He wrote it out for us to see himself. Hume's strict empiricism led to utter skepticism, not simply about God's existence, mind you, but skepticism about the external world, skepticism about the identity of the self, skepticism about all scientific reasoning. Moreover, even Hume's attempt to explain why humans engage in inductive generalizations, he said, by force of natural instinct or habit, they do this regardless of rational justification. But you see, even that attempt rests on the validity of inductive inference, now about human nature and the alleged workings of the human mind and habits and so forth. Furthermore, any attempt to mitigate Hume's skepticism by turning toward a pragmatic interest in action and problem solving and concrete experience rather than theoretical demands of a philosopher is not only a philosophical cop-out, but itself rests upon the premise that experience divulges regularities in the behavior of nature and man from which generalizations we are allowed to make successful plans of action. That is, even the pragmatic attempt to deal with Hume's skepticism rests upon the very regularity of nature which Hume's philosophy rules out as intellectually illegitimate. Hume's anti-metaphysical empiricism proved to destroy objectivity, rationality, and science, even as Dr. Martin's philosophy does as well. Let's take a couple more recent illustrations, Bertrand Russell and Ludwig Wittgenstein. Bertrand Russell was born in 1872, died just recently, actually, in 1970. Russell believed that logical rigor can untangle the age-old puzzles of philosophy. He recommended that philosophy adopt the methods of science, believing that the sciences can yield truth about things, a truth about things which, contrary to pragmatism, resides in correspondence to atomic facts of experience and not merely to the workability of our beliefs. Russell said we should look with skepticism and doubt upon anything that's not susceptible to scientific analysis and proof, such as traditional metaphysics and especially theology. And yet Russell hoped that his logical analysis could surmount the problems of David Hume and make it possible to validate inferences from our momentary sense data to the world of physics, or even the objects of common sense realism that are known by description. He thought he could objectively save scientific knowledge about an objective and external world. Russell was concerned from the very outset of his life with philosophical questions. He writes in Portraits from Memory, "I wanted on the one hand to find out whether anything could be known. Whether anything could be known." According to him, the business of philosophy was to give a general description of the whole universe, an inventory of the kinds of entities that make up the world in which we live, the things that we can know to exist. In My Philosophical Development, published in 1959, he writes, "The constant preoccupation of my life is to discover how much we can be said to know and with what degree of certainty or doubtfulness." Again, in Portraits from Memory, he said that he wanted certainty in the kind of way in which people want religious faith. And yet he was forced to conclude unwillingly that most of what passes for knowledge, he said, is, quote, open to reasonable doubt. Here's Russell with the kind of sharp mental cogency that very few people in the 20th century have evidenced. A notorious philosopher asking, how can we be certain that knowledge is possible? How can we know what actually exists? He wanted to use logical analysis to answer these questions. In 1914, in a lecture entitled "Logic is the Essence of Philosophy," he laid it down, and I quote, "Every philosophical problem, when it's subjected to the necessary analysis and purification, is found either to be not really philosophical at all, or else to be, in the sense in which I am using the word, logical. Logical analysis is what we need. Ordinary language is so incoherent that it disguises the logical form of what we're trying to say and badly misleads philosophers. And so what we need, according to Russell, is a correct analysis of the things we assert, an analysis that will reveal their logical form and lead us then to the solution of our metaphysical questions about what exists. The way to answer those metaphysical questions is to develop a purified language which will picture the world so that every sentence will correspond to a fact or a group of facts in the world, and every word will correspond to an element of a fact. Every word will refer to a thing or a property or a relation. And the perfect language will then consist of the report of momentary sense experiences. And according to Russell, only that which can be translated into this perfect language is knowable. And that led Russell, of course, throughout his career to be critical of many common philosophies to be eliminated because they're unclear. I might mention mind, matter, consciousness, knowledge, experience, causality, will, time. I believe all these notions to be inexact and approximate, essentially infected with vagueness, incapable of forming any part of any exact science. Throughout his career, Russell changed his mind many times about the sorts of things that really belong in the inventory of the universe. At the outset, he thought that the mind, that material objects, universals, particulars and laws of logic belonged in the inventory of what's real. But then subsequently, he dropped material objects. He later dropped minds. Particulars were replaced by qualities. And the only universal that he had any sympathy for was the universal called similarity, the similarity between things. Basic to Russell's thinking was a distinction between what we know by acquaintance, our direct experience with sensation, and the things that we know by description that's built up from what we know from acquaintance and that we know by inference. That is to say, basic to his philosophy was a distinction between hard data, which we know directly, and soft data, which are generalizations and descriptions built up allegedly from the hard data. In my philosophical development, Russell wrote, I still hold that any proposition other than a tautology, if it is true in virtue of a relation to fact, and that facts in general are independent of experience. And so there's the possibility of sensing something, and that's independent of whether it's actually sensed. Then everything that is real is made up of those possibilities of perception. Well, the key problem, as Russell himself was honest enough to point out, the key problem is, can we infer from our direct experience, from our sense data, or the possibilities of sense data, those entities of common sense that we describe in the world? In his book, Our Knowledge of the External World is a Field for Scientific Method in Philosophy, published in 1915, he said, and I quote, the problem really is, can the existence of anything other than our own hard data be inferred from the existence of those data? That's the problem. In my philosophical development, he put it this way, if we know only what can be experienced and verified, then most of what passes for knowledge is not knowledge at all. And so at the end of his career, Russell had to admit to failure, and even worse, for a man who sought certainty about an objective knowledge of an external world, he had to admit to subjectivity. The problem was to show that inferences from hard data to admittedly soft data can be warranted, and that empiricism is compatible then with claims to knowledge of general truths about nature itself. And here's what Russell wrote in 1948 in Human Knowledge, Its Scope and Limits. This is the outcome of the atheist development of a worldview to show that knowledge is possible. He said, although our postulates can be fitted into a framework which has what may be called an empiricist flavor, it remains undeniable that our knowledge of them, insofar as we do know them, cannot be based upon experience. In this sense, it must be admitted, empiricism as a theory of knowledge has proved inadequate. Moreover, Russell pointed out in an Inquiry into Meaning and Truth from 1940 that science, as he wished to pursue it, was really at war with itself. And I quote him, when it most means to be objective, it finds itself plunged into subjectivity against its will. Naive realism leads us to physics, and physics, if true, shows that naive realism is false. Therefore, naive realism, if true, is false. Therefore, it is false. An objective knowledge of the external world that naive realism supposedly gives us is destroyed by empiricism, just as much for Russell as it was for David Hume. Even though Russell hoped that he'd be able to get beyond the problems of Hume, in the end, he succumbed to the same ones. In The Philosophy of Bertrand Russell, the article My Mental Development, he writes, in ontology, I start by accepting the truth of physics. Philosophers must say, what justification have you for accepting the truth of physics? I reply, merely a common sense basis. I believe, though without good grounds, in the world of physics, as well as in the world of psychology. And then later, in the answer to or reply to his critics, Russell said, if we are to hold that we know anything of the external world, we must accept the canons of scientific knowledge. Whether an individual decides to accept or reject these canons is purely a personal affair, not susceptible to argument. Now, what comes of this grand atheistic philosophy of life? If it can't even give a rational foundation for knowing the external world, and Russell says it's all a matter of choice, not susceptible to argument. I think that helps explain why public debate, the realm of argument, is not a comfortable arena for promoting an atheistic worldview. Russell, one of the best of the atheists of the 20th century, said, what I'm trying to say is a matter of choice. It is not susceptible to argument. And lastly, I'd like to look at Russell's best disciple, Ludwig Wittgenstein. For philosophers, this will be the earlier phase of Wittgenstein's career. Most philosophers would be glad to affect in a widespread way the realm of philosophy once in their life. Wittgenstein was given the privilege of doing it twice. He wrote a philosophy that was really monumental early in the 20th century and later refuted his own philosophy. But in the earlier Wittgenstein's work, we find the culmination of Russell's program to use logical analysis to solve philosophical problems. Indeed, Bertrand Russell wrote the introduction to Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. In the Tractatus, Wittgenstein held that since we can make assertions about the world, if we examine the logic of our assertions, that will disclose the general features that the world must have for any assertion about it to be true. That is to say, we can, by logical analysis, determine what can be said about the world. In the introduction to the work, he gives us his orientation. He says, the book deals with the problems of philosophy and shows, I believe, that the reason why these problems are posed is that the logic of our language is misunderstood. The whole sense of the book might be summed up in the following words. What can be said at all can be said clearly, and what we cannot talk about we must pass over in silence. And so the correct method in philosophy is offered by Wittgenstein when he says toward the end of the Tractatus, the correct method in philosophy would really be the following: to say nothing except what can be said, that is, propositions of natural science, that is something that has nothing to do with philosophy, and then whenever someone else wanted to say something metaphysical, to demonstrate to him that he had failed to give a meaning to certain signs in his propositions. Although it would not be satisfying to the other person, he would not have the feeling that we were teaching him philosophy, this method would be the only strictly correct one. And so here we have the philosophy of natural science with a vengeance. And philosophers must teach philosophers what can and cannot be said, what is accessible to us and what is not accessible to us. As he put it, philosophy aims at the logical clarification of thoughts. Most of the propositions and questions to be found in philosophical works are not false, but nonsensical. Most of the propositions and questions of philosophers arise from our failure to understand the logic of our language. And of course, Russell loved that. The logical positivist loved that approach, but it had a major difficulty, as Wittgenstein himself would come to admit. And that is, if his purification of language was going to be as rigorous as he proposed, then it would turn out that the very language he used in the Tractatus would be meaningless, and that he would have refuted himself. And so listen to Wittgenstein's own statements at the end of the Tractatus. He said, "My propositions serve as elucidations in the following way. Anyone who understands me eventually recognizes them as nonsensical when he has used them as steps to climb up beyond them. He must, so to speak, throw away the ladder after he has climbed up it. He must transcend these propositions, and then he will see the world aright." And the stunning last line of the Tractatus is, "Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent." And so where has the atheistic, rigorous approach to philosophy, modeled after natural science, brought us? When we look at Epicurus, when we look at David Hume, Bertrand Russell, or Ludwig Wittgenstein, the worldviews which, like Michael Martin's, are committed in advance to an empirical theory of knowledge based on direct experience and are anti-transcendent in their intent, rejecting any reality beyond our experience, have throughout the history of philosophy shown their futility and their foolishness. They reject theism, but I argue at a philosophical price which is just too high. Epicurus's philosophy was self-refuting. Hume's philosophy resulted in skepticism. Russell's philosophy reduced to subjectivism. And the early Wittgenstein's philosophy rendered itself unsayable. These are the very defects which would prevent Dr. Martin from making a philosophically cogent case for atheism, and would leave him no place to stand in attempting any kind of refutation of theism. A position which is self-refuting or skeptical or subjective or unspeakable cannot hold its own in a debate. If it can't be said, if it's subjective, if it's self-refuting, if it ends in skepticism, it cannot prove that it's correct. In the comparison of worldviews, Martin's atheism, I believe, would be refuted by its own internal flaws, particularly its inability to provide the preconditions for the intelligibility of any human experience or reasoning. See, I think the 19th century nihilist, Friedrich Nietzsche, was really much more candid and much more honest, was much more willing to bite the bullet by accepting the implications of atheism. Nietzsche wrote in The Twilight of the Idols, and this sentence, I think, is a hammer blow, "I am afraid we are not rid of God because we still have faith in grammar." Reflect on that. He said, we have not banished God completely because we still have faith in grammar. As long as we're committed to some kind of universals, rules, standards and the possibility of communication, we are still holding on to God. But of course, Nietzsche wanted to do away with God. Thus spake Zarathustra, God is dead. We need a transvaluation of all values in light of that. And that means there can be no universals and no objective meaning communication. You see, deconstructionism in our modern age is much closer to being sincere in following out atheism to the bitter end than a man who writes a great book trying to rationally communicate his atheism. You see, there is no point to debate when there's no objective truth or meaning to communicate and defend. The deconstructionists, although I disagree with them, at least they're sincere in that. They don't bother to debate. If Michael Martin's atheistic presuppositions are correct, then man has no mental, intellectual freedom to assess evidence and choose the truth. If his atheistic presuppositions are correct, there are no universals of logic or linguistic meaning. If his atheistic presuppositions are correct, there's no rational basis for scientific inductive inference for the uniformity of nature. If his atheistic presuppositions are correct, there's no continuing identity in objects, no personal identity over time in the self. There's no basis for trusting or unifying memories. There's no similarity relation. There's no sex, no numbers, no concepts, no laws. If atheistic presuppositions are correct, there's no such thing as an objective moral obligation, an objective moral obligation. Not even an obligation to be logical or to follow the truth and evidence. You see, if Martin's atheistic presuppositions were correct, he could not communicate, he could not reason, he could not prove his atheism. And that's why I said earlier that Christian theism is proved from the impossibility of the contrary proving anything at all. It's only within the Christian worldview that the preconditions of rationality and debate can be offered. Christian theism, to conclude this part of my lecture, has a transcendental necessity. It alone provides the worldview, which is the precondition for the intelligibility of man's experience, his knowledge, and his conduct. Finally, we take a breather. I want to turn to something else now, because without my debate opponent here, it might seem, well, this is a little unfair, Dr. Bonson. You've been able to go on and make this point. But what would you say to an intelligent atheist and the sorts of arguments that he'd offer in return? Even though Dr. Martin's not here, we do have his book as something of a stand-in, Atheism, a Philosophical Justification. And because I know that you're going to be worn out from all this long and detailed lecturing if I don't abbreviate, I'd like to encourage you, this is not a commercial, we don't have it to show up here, but I do have tapes where I did a long 3-day seminar analyzing this book by Michael Martin. If you want to pursue more, you can do that by way of tape. In this book, Dr. Martin tells us what his purpose is. To quote him, "My object is merely to provide good reasons for being an atheist. Atheism is defended and justified. I present a comprehensive critique of the arguments for the existence of God, although the long argument you've heard tonight does not appear in this book for analysis, showing in detail their relevance to atheism. My object is to show that atheism is a rational position and that belief in God is not. I am quite aware that theistic beliefs are not always based on reason. My claim is that they should be, and I agree with that, they should be. However, I want to say, I'm not sure why he says that. Given his atheistic worldview, why is there any moral obligation to base our beliefs on anything, much less evidence? I confine my efforts to showing the irrationality of belief in the existence of the Hebrew Christian God." So you know what his intention is. He wants to show that my theism is irrational and that his atheism is rationally justified. I'd like to make a few observations about the book. It's a long book, and I'm being brief, so I'm not going to pretend this is adequate, but we can at least get the general outline of a refutation in front of ourselves. First of all, you need to know that for all of his erudition, which I respect, Dr. Martin is certainly not infallible. He's not always accurate in his scholarship. A good example is when he tries to tell us what the word atheism means. And he takes us back to the Greek original, atheos, and then he says, so you have the Greek word, a, alpha privative, no, theos, God, and then ism, which is like a belief. And so he says, so atheism is the lack of a belief in God. A-ism, theos. That's a rather strange method for showing us what atheism means when you stop and think about it. Greek has no suffix ism. Atheism is an English word. And one is not going to be able to prove the meaning of atheism by the Greek original anyway. And so you need to be careful that though there's the outward show of erudition in some cases, Dr. Martin doesn't always know what he's talking about. He certainly does not know what he's talking about when he criticizes the theologian Charles Hodge, which just happens to be, incidentally, one of my specializations. And so when I read what he says about Hodge, and I can go to Hodge and show that he said the very opposite of what Martin presents in his saying, and answers questions which Martin says he doesn't consider at all, then I've got to worry about the scholarship that I find elsewhere in the book as well. This is especially important because Hodge deals with the innate knowledge of God. And when Martin tries to counter what we claim to be the innate knowledge of God, it seems to me that he uses very poor counter evidence. An example of this is on page 37 of his book, when he tells us, one may well question whether there's a natural tendency to believe in God or whether the tendency is based on cultural and social training. If there were such a natural tendency, one would expect belief in God to be statistically uniform in different cultures. However, it varies widely across cultures. Well, the difficulty with that line of thinking is that what Christian theism teaches is not simply that man has a natural or innate knowledge of God, but man is also naturally in rebellion against that knowledge, in which case the way in which it comes to expression should not be expected to be statistically uniform throughout cultures. Any number of forms of non-Christian conceptions of God or atheism can develop around man's rebellion against God as well. That may be true, that may be false, but you see, you can't refute the theory without taking into account all that the theory contains. I think that we see similar inaccuracies when Dr. Martin deals with the philosophy, the later philosophy of Ludwig Wittgenstein. But I say this only by way of introduction. Just think for yourselves, do your research, don't trust him or me, you know, to be giving it to you straight. You're going to have to do some cross-examination. Now, here's the first major problem I have with the book beyond that minor difficulty with some accuracy of scholarship. Martin displays a very strong prejudice for atheism. Now, I'm prejudiced for theism. Somebody might say, what's your complaint? My complaint is he doesn't admit that prejudice. He tries to present the idea that he's really doing philosophical analysis and being neutral about this. And yet the very first sentence of the book, the very first sentence begs the question. Let me read the first sentence. He says, non-belief in the existence of God is a worldwide phenomenon with a long and distinguished history. Somebody might say, well, how can you have any problem with that, Dr. Bonson? Non-belief in the existence of God is a worldwide phenomenon. Well, but if Dr. Martin were familiar with the school of philosophy and apologetics that I represent, I don't mean familiar with me, I mean, I'm nobody to him, but it's a long, distinguished school of thought, he would know that there's at least some versions of theism that claim there are no atheists, that there are those who profess atheism all the while secretly relying on a theistic worldview. Now, they may be right, they may be wrong. All I'm saying is you can't open your book by dismissing the strongest, you know, school of thought that stands over against your book. So there's a very strong prejudice here, and that comes out in some cases in the form of blatant bias. So many cases are here that I won't bore you with all of them, but just a couple might amuse you. At a point where Martin is criticizing the sexual and racial discrimination of the Mormons from some years ago, which I would criticize as well, but I want you to hear the way he criticizes it. He says, "It's not implausible to suppose that most enlightened people today believe that this practice and the beliefs on which it rests are wrong." Most enlightened people today? That look a little like question begging to you? That is, anybody who would defend the Mormons, I'm not one, but anyone who would defend the Mormons is dismissed as not enlightened, right? It's even worse on page 260. Martin is dealing with how do we respond to the rationality of belief such as that material objects vanish into thin air. And I love this sentence. He says, "There are in our society no sane people other than professional philosophical skeptics who question that kind of view." No sane people. The one exception being philosophers. Philosophers do that sort of thing, but we all know they're insane, I guess. But what do you do with this when you say, when you're defending your position by saying, well, no sane person, you know, is going to do that or believe that sort of thing. No enlightened person today believes that, or most enlightened people are not going to believe that. These are blatant biases that apparently he's not even aware of as he writes, because it happens over and over again. Indeed, repeatedly, Dr. Martin appeals in his discussion of the meaningfulness of religious language. Repeatedly, he appeals to intuition. I find that amazing. The first time it happened, you have to try to be charitable and read your opponent in the best possible light. I said, I'm sure he didn't really mean it in that way. But then he does it on page 47, page 48, page 49, page 52, page 58, page 59, page 486, page 488. The whole defense of his view of the meaninglessness of religious language eventually comes down to appeals to what is intuition about our linguistic usage on his part. Well, when you appeal to intuition, basically you're showing us what your prejudices are. You're not giving us objective evidence. Indeed, Martin is not even critical of his own crucial assumptions. I'd love to be able to have 3 days to illustrate these things for you, but I'll just choose one from page 198. He's arguing against miracles, and I'm not trying to resurrect the argument from miracles necessarily here, but I want you to see how Martin doesn't even look at himself in light of the things that he's saying. I'm quoting him. "Further, alleged miracles may not be due to some trick or fraud, but to a misperception based on religious bias. People full of religious zeal may see what they want to see, not what is really there. We know from empirical studies that people's beliefs and prejudices influence what they see and report." Wouldn't it be nice if the sentence went on to say, "and influence what they don't see and don't report"? Isn't that also something that psychological studies will tell us? It would not then be surprising that religious people who report seeing a miraculous event have projected their biases onto the actual event. Did Jesus still storm, or did the storm by coincidence happen to stop when he rose and rebuked the wind and sea? And did witnesses in their religious zeal see him stilling the storm? Well, but you see, that same kind of observation is reversible. Isn't it just possible that given psychological disposition to not believe, that when the evidence is there, you rationalize it and come up with other explanations of it? He says, "Religious attitudes often foster uncritical belief and acceptance." He says, "A belief arising in a religious context and held at first with only modest conviction may tend to reinforce itself and develop into an unshakable conviction." Well, yes, I'm sure that's true. But I'm equally sure that people who are raised in atheistic environments also have that dynamic philosophically and psychologically take place in them. That fosters an uncritical belief in the non-existence of God, which tends to reinforce itself when you live in that kind of community very long. Now, there's no argument pro or con for the existence of God in this comment. All I'm saying is this scholar, for all of his vast reading and knowledge, and I respect him for that, is not self-critical. He doesn't apply to himself the very kinds of leading questions and observations that he applies to his opponents. And indeed, as we'll see in a few moments, he's willing to go to extremes to protect his atheism. That is to say, Michael Martin will violate exemplars of rationality in philosophical circles if that's what is required to defend atheism. I believe that he's overreaching and he's very hasty in his dogmatism throughout this book many times, which is not the mark of a cautious scholar. Listen to this conclusion, page 277. He says, although not all theories of faith have been examined here, the ones that were are representative enough to give us confidence that all such arguments will fail. Well, I mean, that's just kind of pushing a little too hard, especially when the conception of faith that I would be debating with him tonight is not even found in the book. That doesn't mean that, you know, he needs to know me, but I represent a long tradition in Christian theology on a certain view of faith, which is Augustinian, Calvinistic, and so forth, and he doesn't deal with that. And then he says, well, but the ones I have dealt with are representative enough that we can be sure that all of them will fail as well. Okay, so the book shows a great prejudice for atheism. It's not all good argumentation. And much of what's found in the book rests upon vacuous argumentation. Repeatedly, you'll find Dr. Martin pontificating rather than offering proof at crucial points in his discussion. Over and over and over again in the book, you'll see him use epistemic epithets, if I can use that term, about what is reasonable, what is plausible, what is more likely, what is more probable, what is simpler by way of explanation, what is absurd, what is irrational, what an intelligent person would believe, what is seriously accepted today, what makes good sense, what offers good reason, what is conceivable, what is necessary, what is normal, what is strongly suggested by the evidence, what excellent reason points to, what is intelligible. And I've just made a small list in this long book. Over and over and over again, he refers to terms like that to support his argumentation. Well, that's not plausible, or no serious person would believe. Well, that's not argumentation, you see. And even worse, when he makes reference to what he says is plausible, reasonable, absurd, irrational, on and on and on, it turns out by his own admission he has no uncontroversial and general epistemological theory on which to rely in using epithets about what is rational, plausible, and all the rest. Michael Martin cannot make sense of speaking of justification of beliefs or proof. And indeed, he cannot provide the preconditions for science and rationality and overcome the skepticism of Hume and the other problems that we saw earlier tonight, because he says that he has no general developed epistemological theory in terms of which he can talk about what we know, don't know, what is rational, what is irrational, what is plausible, implausible. I quote page 25. Although I argue that atheistic belief is rational, okay, what does that mean? And justified, what does that mean? Although I argue that atheistic belief is rational and justified, and that theism is not, no extended theory of rationality or justification is given. No doubt the few general comments I do make about these topics are controversial. Given the controversial state of general epistemological theories, it is far better, in my view, to develop certain middle-level principles of justification that are in accord with our ordinary and scientific rational practice, and to argue for atheism in terms of these than to justify atheism in terms of some larger and more controversial theory. I provide no general account of inductive arguments. I appeal to common rational practices, regardless of how their details are construed by inductive logicians. Well, I want you to put the picture together. Here's a man who says, I'm going to show that atheism is rational, but I'm not going to give you a general theory of rationality by which you could evaluate that claim. I'm going to appeal to our common practices of rationality. But then, of course, any time a theist enters the picture, that can't be rational. Well, but then one wants to know, what is the general theory of rationality by which you accept or reject examples? Michael Martin is begging the question, is what I'm telling you. He's not so much showing the rationality of atheism as simply setting it forth as his view and then saying, whatever my view is what's going to accord with rationality. And this, I think, this criticism is especially applicable to what he takes to be the major or the key criticism of theology. According to Michael Martin, the statement God exists is factually meaningless. Now, that argument has a long history, and you don't want to hear it all tonight. And most people, if I could now have the pleasure of begging the question, most people today in philosophical circles, in the area of epistemology, don't follow the logical positivism that Michael Martin does. Now, that doesn't mean that he's wrong. Don't take me, in the wrong way here. He might be right. But nevertheless, he's trying to argue for a position which has been discredited, I think, by many people, even people who have no religious sympathies, have discredited the attack on the meaningfulness of religious language. And so you need to hear what Michael Martin says, though he tries to resurrect these arguments and to hold that they're still cogent. He says, although a complete defense of this criterion, the criterion of meaningfulness or verification, although a complete defense of this criterion needs a developed theory of meaning, there is a good prima facie reason to adopt this criterion even now. Really? That is to say, we can by faith accept that there's a general criterion of meaningfulness that has not been developed yet by the atheist, and that he wants to use that as yet undeveloped theory to discount the meaningfulness of religious language. Well, that's just incredible question begging. He says, it's not necessary to have a completely worked out theory of confirmation or induction to realize that typical alleged counterexamples to the verifiability theory of meaning only end up showing that an inadequate view of confirmation has been assumed. You can realize that without a general theory? Well, one must wonder then, how does a person, by what basis or standard, does one realize that these counterexamples are no big deal? On pages 77 and 78, Martin says, the thesis that the sentences God exists and God does not exist are factually meaningless is only prima facie justified. This is so because a commonly accepted and fully developed theory of meaning is not yet available. And then he goes on to say, even this partial justification could be undermined. He admits that. Well, if you will pick up my article, The Problem of Religious Language, I think you'll see how this argument that he offers can be undermined. He's certainly right about that. But his point is, we don't have a general theory in terms of which we can justify my critique of theism. Secondly, it's evident to me that Michael Martin does not self-critically distinguish between someone saying, I don't accept any empirical evidence as confirming theism, and there is no empirical evidence offered which is relevant to confirming theism. These two points are merged by him. Moreover, I would argue and have in many of my tapes that every event that we know is evidence for God's existence. And therefore, every event which is knowable makes God talk factually meaningful. Martin doesn't deal with that. Fourthly, I believe that Wittgenstein, in his development of a view of language games and linguistic communities, provides a far better context for understanding meaningfulness than does the logical positivism to which my opponent would be committed. But then finally, in terms of a self-refutation, after Martin spends a good portion of the opening of his book arguing that religious talk is not even meaningful, he goes on to refute it in various ways. He says, "I act as if talk about God is factually meaningful and develop the case for negative atheism on independent grounds." Well, but you see, he can't have it both ways now, can he? If it's meaningless, then you can't act as though it's meaningful. The very fact that you can act as though it's meaningful shows that it is meaningful. It doesn't show that it's true, but it shows that it is meaningful. And so Michael Martin is his own worst opponent when it comes to his major critique of theism here. And so I believe that Martin's case turns out to be a long, circular argument, which basically begs the question, ultimately, as to whether God exists or not. Secondly, his major criticism about the factual meaninglessness of theism is undermined by a number of conceptual confusions on his own part and disproven by his own practice of arguing against theism and acting as if it were meaningful. Thirdly, I believe that he has not rebutted the best argument for God's existence, and therefore what he calls negative theism has failed. Negative theism, according to Martin, is believing that God exists is not epistemically justified. Negative theism is just saying you theists don't have good justification for what you believe. Positive theism is saying that there's evidence that God does not exist. So I hope you can understand the difference. One is, I don't believe that there's good evidence for God's existence. The other is, I believe there is evidence that God does not exist. Well, the first claim has not been shown because Martin doesn't even deal with the strongest case for Christian theism, which is summarized in my earlier presentation tonight, the transcendental argument for God's existence. This argument was developed in the Proverbs, in the Apostle Paul, Tertullian, Augustine, Calvin, Van Til, and others along the way, and yet it doesn't even show up in the book. And where there are some isolated elements of transcendental argumentation that appear, not the argument itself, even they are not dealt with in a cogent way. I'm going to give you one example from page 194. Martin responds to C.S. Lewis's refutation of naturalism, and he says, and I quote, "There's no reason why naturalists cannot use terms such as truth, validity, and probability to explicate rational thinking. Indeed, this is precisely what recent naturalists have done." Well, not done, have attempted. But the problem is, naturalism cannot justify logical validity because nothing in the natural experience of man, nothing empirical, has the qualities which characterize logical validity. And so we have one sentence trying to deal with what is really an overwhelming refutation of his naturalism. And basically the one sentence is simply the statement, there's no reason why we can't on a natural basis have logical validity. Well, there's every reason, because the characteristics of logical validity are not the characteristics of natural experience. That's the problem, and it's not surmounted. And so Martin has not done well in his major critique of theism. He has not even considered the strongest argument for God's existence. And then finally, when he presents evidence for positive theism, that is, believing that God does not exist, I think that he fails as well. And I'll be very brief here for you. He says, first of all, theism, Christian theism, traditional theism, is incoherent in its view of the divine attributes. So he does an analysis of various attributes like omniscience and omnipotence and so forth to show that they cannot be coherently stated. And I want to point out that in all of this, it's chapter 12 where he does this, in all of this, he often assumes mistaken views of human freedom, divine freedom, or other theological concepts. Secondly, he, in the end, is really only playing with the logical and linguistic puzzles that arise from universal affirmations and self-reference, something that I know a little bit about since I wrote my doctoral dissertation on one of the self-reference problems known as self-deception. But basically, what Martin does throughout the book is he plays all these games with how can you say God knows or can do all the following, and then certain problems of self-reference come in. Basically, he himself offers the refutation of his own chapter when he says that if we do not accept his analysis of these divine attributes, then we may not have the problems that he is trying to pin on us. Well, I don't accept his analysis, and I believe that better ones can be provided. Indeed, chapter 12 is a long lesson, I think, in how not to do theology, trying to speculate in terms of general statements and terms that are not given in God's self-revelation, and devise a theology that is going to be consistent with itself. Christians are not bound to all extra-biblical summary words and any or all linguistic habits pertaining to such words or their components when we express our Christian theology. Rather, Christians define God's attributes and sometimes use extra-biblical terms as summaries when they'd like to, but they define these terms according to biblical information and exemplars, in which case everything is contextualized by the entire self-revelation of God. And when those implicit qualifications are taken into account, all of these alleged problems presented by Michael Martin go away. I can give you one quick example. Can God do everything? See, the doctrine that God is omnipotent is supposed to state he can do everything. But that's not the Christian concept of God's omnipotence. It may be an easy handle or a simple summary, but it's not attenuated in the biblical way. Because the Bible says there are at least two things God cannot do. First of all, he cannot lie. Secondly, the Bible says he cannot deny himself. And so the omnipotence of God, biblically defined, doesn't run into many of the cheap, problems that atheists like to throw at Christian theology. Secondly, Martin offers not just the incoherence of the divine attributes, but his final argument is a problem.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, BonsonInstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.